Well, ladies and gentlemen, it gives me very great pleasure to introduce this, the second of a series of three lectures on the Russian economy given by Mr. Gaidar, and I'm sure that Mr. Gaidar needs no introduction from me, or indeed introduction to you, but for those who weren't able to come to the first lecture, let me just briefly say that he was director of the Institute of Economic Policy in Moscow up to November 1991, when he became deputy prime minister in charge of the economy. He became acting prime minister in summer of 1992 and was replaced during the Congress in December 1992. He's now director of the Institute of Economics in Transition and, of course, remains an advisor to President Yeltsin. I think it's also fair to say that we at the LSE like to think that we have a rather special relationship both with Mr. Gaidar and his institute, because we are delighted that some of his former assistants are now students at the school, and of course he has encouraged some of our colleagues, especially Professor Richard Layard, to become involved in working with the Russian government. Well, this is, as I said, the second of three lectures. Yesterday, Mr. Gaidar gave a wonderfully clear analysis of the problems of trying to reform the old communist system from within. He described how Mr. Gorbachev first tried to increase the investment rate, but ended up merely by increasing the inflation. How he then tried to improve the quality of management, and finally embarked on a democratic experiment without realizing where it would inevitably lead. This evening, he's going to talk about the reform process from after the putsch onwards, and also about the problem of creating a middle class in what used to be the Soviet Union. Mr. Gaidar.
Dear ladies and gentlemen, maybe you'd remember that immediately after the August coup, the attempt of the August coup of the year 91, there was a very strange period of the very well-seen passivity of the Russian leadership. It seemed that when the victory was won, the enemy destroyed, there will be very, very rapid changes in the political or economic structures, very rapid reforms, etc. But by the contrast with the expectations, there was the period in September and until the middle of October when there was practically very little done in Russia in the direction of the reforms. And really, it is easy to understand why this rather strange for the foreign observer period was inevitable. Well, the victory of the Democrats was a great surprise to themselves. They have a very stable world in which they have a strong enemy, Communist Party, Union Center, with whom they were prepared for a long time to fight. There was the system of the alliances with the other Republican leaders that would like to increase their power, popularity, and prestige. They were fighting for the improvement of the Russian relationship abroad and for at least some signs of the recognition from the big G7 countries of the Russian sovereignty. The broad coalition that really created the basis of the President Yeltsin electoral success was really the very broad populist anti-communist coalition in which there was incorporated various forces from the true liberals to the radical nationalist and practically the fascist. In a few months, it was evident that this coalition would not survive the practical beginning of the economic reforms. During the political battle with the communists, they used to promise a lot to the Russian population. They promised to increase their expenditure on the social programs, promised not to increase the prices, promised various kinds of protection, etc. Well, now, all at once, from the 22nd of August of the year 91, all of the responsibility was in one day on the shoulders of the President Yeltsin. The Gorbachev was yet in the Kremlin. There was something left from the Union government. He was accepting the foreign visitors, etc. But in the public conscience of average Russian citizen, now Yeltsin was responsible for everything that happens in Russia. He was responsible for the shortages. He was responsible for the lack of food. He was responsible for the long lines for bread, etc. I do remember quite well that at least those communists who were more intelligent were not at all dissatisfied with this situation. They would understand and they would believe that in a very few months, the Democrats, unable to deal with the difficult problems of the Russian economy and the Russian society, would lost all of its popularity. And the people once more would like to invite the old bosses from the communist nomenclature. And it was quite a real danger of this outcome of the events. It was very difficult to confront it with any clear, sensible, and realistic political and economical strategy. What practically Yeltsin had to confront at the 22nd of August? What was the real situation of Russia economy and Russian society? First of all, it was quite evident, and I mentioned it yesterday, that the old system of management do not work and will not work anymore. The harvest was bad, but the crisis of the state purchases of the grain was especially evident after August. It was clear that the reserves of grain that were accumulated during the period before the August, that this reserve would last approximately until the beginning of January. And from this period, how really to supply the bread to the big Russian cities was absolutely unclear. It was very difficult even to redistribute the state reserves of grain from the regions when they were relatively abundant, like the Stavropol, Krasnodar, Rostov Oblast, to the regions of the most serious short supply, like Moscow and St. Petersburg, because the region authorities would prohibit the redistribution of these reserves. The orders were not absolutely inefficient anymore, but the trade was not working either. The most pressing problem of the Russian industry at the autumn of the year 91 probably is the problem of the metal and the problem of the coking coal. The miners would not provide the coking coal to the metallurgical plants except for the metals they are producing. So it was impossible to buy the coking coal. Metallurgical plants could only get the coking coal for the exchange for the metal. Then miners would try to exchange this metal, for instance, for automobiles produced in Tolyatti. And then to change these automobiles, for instance, for the foodstuffs. It was more or less better for the miners. But for instance, for the oil producers, which have only one consumer, and that is the petrochemical plant. And it was very difficult to get, for instance, necessary metal for continuing oil production, because the metal that was needed for the oil producers was now in the hands of the miners. That was a terribly unstable and unmanageable economy, which is always very close to the very serious distortions, the very serious problems of the supply on the most basic branches of national economy. For instance, it is very difficult to barter electroenergy for different kinds of goods. But it does not mean that the electroenergy, for instance, can live without the spare parts, without the energy, etc. All the same, even in this very difficult situation, various branches of the industry that were absolutely unnecessary in the times of this so severe crisis were continuing to process. For instance, it was evident signs of problems, for instance, in the heating system in Moscow, in St. Petersburg. But all the same, a lot of metal or and energy was used to enormous amount of military equipment production, for instance, or for the long-term investment projects with absolutely unpredictable results. So it was increasing crisis with a terribly with a terrible management of this crisis. The industrial production was down at the time approximately 12% from the highest level of the year 1989, and the drop was continuing without any serious and positive changes in the system of economic management. Generally, the population in September was prepared to real hunger, to real catastrophe with the food supply, to real catastrophe with the transportation, to the distortions of the heating system in the big cities, so to the very, very real energy and house in Russian economy and Russian society. If you, for instance, now would reread the press of this period, if you would remember overall, or you would once more try to view the Russian television of the period of the autumn of the year 91, you will see that it was not discussions about, for instance, what is the better, what is the best possible rate of the inflation, or what is the sensible strategy of economic reform. But the most serious problem was whether the country will survive during next winter. That was most pressing question, most interesting question, the question that was most broadly discussed at this period of time. What were real possibilities, instrument that Yeltsin had in his hands? It is difficult to remember now, but you should remember that even after the August coup, the union institution formally existed. Of course, they were absolutely inefficient. They had no legitimacy. They could do nothing. Practically, they was first of all engaged in trying to redistribute at least some property of the union institution to the private hands of those employed in this institution. But all the same, formally, this institution existed. Army was, Soviet army then, was under the strong influence of August coup and the events of the previous 2 years before the August coup. Various times the civil leadership before the August coup would order an army to repress the manifestations of the people will and then refuse to be responsibility for it, putting the responsibility on the army. The universal feeling in the army after the August coup was that we will not mess in the politics. We will do nothing that is connected with the politics, with the repressions, etc. Keep us out of these processes. It was probably the period of the most serious weakness of all of the Russian, all the Soviet military institution, the period in which it was possible, for instance, to take from the army a lot of military equipment or to steal this military equipment without any serious response from the military institution. So you should exempt army from the instrument that was really in the disposal of the new Russian government. Army would be neutral, it will not mess in the politics, it would not fulfill any orders connected with its involvement in the resolution of internal conflicts. Well, Ministry of Interior, not to the same extent, but approximately the same situation. The lack of will to implement the force for resolution of any political conflicts. Well, relationships with the local governments, with the republics, autonomous republics, oblast, and other regions of Russia. In a quite majority of them, there was a strong communist majority in the local councils. Union government used to play with these regional governments for the support and for the trying to create the coalition against the Yeltsin. The legitimacy of the federal Russian government from the point of view of the local Soviet is very limited. So it is very uncertain that they will fulfill any orders from Moscow. There is a strong contradiction between the Russian legislation and the Union legislation. And the enterprises, local authorities, has a lot of possibility of not fulfilling any orders that they are giving from Moscow. So that means that if Yeltsin would adopt the strategy of enforcing the order by force, of an emergency rule, of the specific orders that would make the region supply, for instance, food to Moscow and St. Petersburg, he just would not have an instrument with which it would be possible to implement these orders. Practically, I'm absolutely sure that an attempt in the autumn of the year 91 to introduce the emergency law and to make the regions obey the orders from Moscow would be the prologue to this disintegration of Russia and to the civil war in Russia. The history of an attempt of introduction of the emergency law in a small Chechnya, which was evidently inefficient because of a contradiction between the Union government and the Russian government, was a very clear example of inability of the federal authorities in this period of time to use these kind of measures in dealing with the economic crisis. Well, of course, Yeltsin could try to organize the barter trade and manage somehow the barter economy. For instance, to try to accumulate some reserves of the industrial goods that could be interchanged for the grain in the countryside, etc. That's exactly what the Russian government was trying to do during the year 90 and 91. But results were terribly inefficient. It was very clear from the time of Kerensky in the 17th, who tried exactly the same policy, that it will not present any sensible results because you just cannot, at this situation, accumulate the necessary amount of industrial resources that could be efficiently traded, for instance, for the basic commodity, foodstuffs for basic commodities. So that means that this those directions practically are blocked. What is left? Practically, that means that you have only one alternative left, and that is to try very rapidly to transform repressed inflation to the open inflation, to liberalize prices, to liberalize an economy, to introduce the market mechanisms, and then on the basis of these market mechanisms to resolve the most basic crisis of the economic management. So if the old style economic regulation based on the direct orders doesn't work anymore, you should go as rapidly forward in the direction of the creation of the new mechanism of micro-regulation as you can. Well, it is more or less clear. But then, what are the chances that these new mechanisms of economic management practically will work? And here, analyzing the situation, you see that these chances are not high at all. You don't only need the free liberal prices, liberalized prices to get the market mechanisms at work. You need a lot more, and at least the minimal requirement is some resemblance of the stable finance. Other way around, you are risking that immediately after you are liberalizing the prices, you are in the midst of hyperinflation, with the money that doesn't work any whatsoever, and with the same barter trade you're trying to avoid. Well, the chances that price liberalization in Russia will immediately result in the hyperinflation looked very serious at the autumn of the year 91. First of all, it is enormous financial disbalances. The GDP in the fourth quarter of the year 91 is higher than 20% of budget deficit in the fourth quarter of the year 91 is higher than 20% of country's GDP. It is very difficult to estimate correctly the monetary overhang accumulated during the latest years of the financial disorders of the Gorbachev period, but it is evident that it is present and that is quite important. Well, in the presence of so enormous financial disbalances, you can expect that immediate reaction would be the drastic increase of the velocity of money, the uncontrollable increase of the prices, the runaway inflation, and then reappearance of the old-style mechanism of the shortage redistribution. For instance, in December or November, if you would try to pursue anybody in Russia that in a two-month period of time the enterprise would really worry about financial results, would try to sell the products, that it would be possible to buy anything for rubles, you would look like a fool. Nobody would just believe you. They would smile at you. Because it was clear that it will never be the fact. It is impossible. So it was very strongly incorporated in the habits of everyday economic life. You just cannot buy anything for money. Our state trade is institutionally structured in the way that the money is not important. It was a very strong tradition of the social stratification connected with the access of the resources in the short supply. The man who has a friend in the shop, the man who has a friend who has an access to limited resources, was an important member of the society. He was so-called уважаемый человек, the man of the honor. If you just have money and you don't have any connections, you do not have any access of distribution of the goods in the short supply, you're nobody. Your money just shows that you have no position in this society. And of course, it was not for a year or for 2 years, it was for the decades. The grandmothers were born in this society, they were accustomed, all of this, their life passed under this tradition. And they were absolutely sure that this tradition will survive. All of the nonsense that these youngsters are telling just could not change the everyday habits of their life that are strongly incorporated during the decades. So, the things that we really feared most when we started the reform was that after the price liberalization, the stereotypes, the ways of behavior of the shortage economy would prevail. That all the same, even with the free prices, with a very high inflation, you will not be in a position to buy anything for rubles. Of course, the prices will be changed every day, but all the same, you will be in a position to buy anything only if you are changing it for serious goods, not for money that it is practically meaningless. Well, that means that if we had a chance to practically change this attitude and to introduce quite another forms of economic regulation, we had to be very, very radical in the removal of these greatest financial disbalances, in the improving of financial discipline, into imposing the financial indiscipline on the enterprises, on the state, on the budget, on the industries. Well, but it was of course much easier to tell than practically to do. We were happy only in one respect. After the August coup, all the structure of the political support of the interest of the different branches of the economy and society for a short period of time disappeared or were strongly demoralized. For instance, the leader of the military-industrial complex lobby, Mr. Tizakov, member of the GKCP, now in prison. Leader of the agricultural lobby of the collective farm and the state farms, Mr. Stradubtsev, member of the GKCP, now in prison. Of course, the Soviet army, practically non-existent, Russian army non-existent yet. So we were in a very short-term situation in which the possibility of political maneuver and the possibility of accepting responsibility for a harsh and unpleasant measure is relatively high. So probably it is only sensible way in this situation is try to use this possibility as radically as we could, removing these financial disbalances. Most serious problem that we also had to have in mind was connected with the lack of normal institutions of the state in the hands of the Russian government. Well, you have to remember that at this time, Russia had no borders. Russia had no custom, its union's custom, and it doesn't work anymore. It doesn't have normal central bank. We have 16 central banks, and just in November, the Gosbank of the Soviet Union are issuing its latest big credits to the Union government. And all of the central banks of the republics are issuing the credits to the government without any coordination. Of course, you do understand that in a very strongly tight Soviet economy, it is impossible, for instance, in a few week period of time, to introduce a republican currency. To introduce the republican currency, especially in Russia, means the radical changing in the mechanisms of the interlinkages of the economy of Russia and another republics. You need a lot, really, to prepare this type of reform. You cannot do it in a month or even 2 or 3 months. So that means that you either have to try to negotiate the sensible common financial policy with the republics, or you have to try to go in the direction of the financial corrections yourself, and then you will have to see what the other republics will do. Most serious alternative was exactly at this point, whether to try to do it together with the republics or to try to do it only in Russia, urging another republics to follow our example. We tried to negotiate the joint reform program efforts with the republics, but the results were terribly disappointing. First of all, the economic and political situation in the different republics was very, very strongly differentiated. Their perspectives of the economic transformation differs very seriously. Part of them seriously was interested in the continuation of the huge subsidies that we're getting from Russia. In a few weeks, we could agree on the joint monetary policy, and then, for instance, in a 2 or 3 week period of time, to know from the press that Ukraine introduced its own coupon. So it was clear that either we will continue to discuss month and month the possibility of the joint economic program, or we will practically start the transformation. The thing that created hope for the success was that Russia is practically something 65% of the Russian economy, and of course the changes, practical changes in Russia, create enormous stimuli for the change in the other republics. So we decided to, first of all, to try to start alone, urging another republic to follow our example, to start with a very radical liberalization of the economy, with a price liberalization, and to try to combine this price liberalization with a very radical corrections of the financial disbalances. Well, first of all, we drastically reduced the amount of military spending. When we started to work in the government, I invited to join our government Mr. Barchuk, who was later Minister of Finance in our government, and then he was the Deputy Minister of Finance of the Union government in charge of the budget. Mr. Barchuk was a long-term financial bureaucrat, very experienced in the Soviet Union Ministry of Finance, with a long battle for the budget, with the different branches of this industry. And we started to discuss the points of how practically, drastically to improve the budget balance. He told me that it is absolutely impossible. It's absolutely impossible to do. I told him it is possible because it is always the problem not of the economic possibility but of political will. Well, he answered me, well, that's fine. Try to cut down military expenditure by 30%. So we decided not to cut it by 30% but to cut it by 70%. I think, of course, it is absolutely clear for me that it was a unique moment when it was possible. 4 months later, or 3 months earlier, it would be absolutely unbelievable even to discuss these amounts of the cuts in the military expenditure. But that was the moment of the demoralization of the old military industrial lobby, and we really decided to cut very drastically, very dramatically, the amount of the expenditure on the defense. Of course, I can understand the contra-arguments that were usually held against our approach. The contra-arguments of the nature that you should try to convert the military industry step by step, that the military industry needs the time to adapt to the new reality. You should have a long-term program. You should cut it by 5%, etc., etc. I am absolutely sure that if in Russia, where the military economy is not a part of the economy, it is really the center of the economy, the essence of the economy, we would adopt this approach, we would never convert our military industry. The Gorbachev tried this step-by-step approach. It leads nowhere. When, until the military industry believes it will get its military orders, it has a thousand reasons why it is impossible to start the production of the civil production, start producing civil production. Thousand explanations. You need conversion? Well, very well. Provide us with additional billions and the billions of rubles to build a new production facilities, and then we'll discuss all of it. Only when we drastically reduce the amount of the military order, and we, for instance, cut the amount of the tank production by 38 times, or the amount of the armored personnel carriers by 34 times, etc. So it was quite a drastic reduction in the many branches, especially branches producing the ordinary equipment, on which, for instance, we had more tanks in our country than all of the world. Why? And we are continuing production in a time of severe crisis, producing more tanks than all of the world were producing. So that created an enormous additional facility to adopt to the new, very rapidly changing situation. For instance, I do remember very well how for the years we were getting the explanations from military industry why, for instance, it was absolutely impossible to start the local production of the oil and gas equipment. So we had to import in enormous quantities the oil and gas equipment from the world market. Now, in a few months, our oil and gas production enterprises were full with the proposals of the military plants to start the production of this type of the equipment. The similar situation was in many different branches of the industry. What was especially important was the fact that military enterprises, usually rather adaptable to the new production lines, were used as reserves in the situation, in the economic ties that were undermined by the dissolution of the Soviet Union. For instance, some Lithuanian enterprise stopped supplying the spare parts for the automobile production in Tallahassee. Immediately, military factories are entering this market. The Ukrainian factory stopped to produce motors for the enterprises in Altai and Krasnoyarsk. Immediately, military factories are entering this market, etc. So practically, we created some very mobile technological resources that could be used in this time of severe crisis. The second very drastic solution was, of course, the solution to cut down drastically the amount of subsidies. At the end of the year 91, subsidies to the consumer prices included something like 15% of GDP. Of course, it was evident that it is impossible to eliminate them entirely, But we hope that we will be in a position to keep these subsidies on a relatively on a level at least 2 times lower and probably even lower than in the year 91. Well, of course, it created also additional and very serious problems with the industries that are used to getting these subsidies. First of all, with our terribly inefficient agricultural production. But we also thought that it is only existing possibility, and we have no other choice. Very difficult problem was connected with tax reform. At this moment, at the end of the year 91, the old system of the taxation were practically destroyed by the battle for popularity between the Russian and the Union government. Union government tried to introduce the sales tax, which resembles in our practice with evaluated tax. But its efforts were undermined by decisions of the Republican parliaments. We had practically 2 possible solutions. Either we could use the existing turnover tax and to try to convert this turnover tax into the ad valorem tax. So, making it elastic in the time of the high inflation, because previously it was incalculated in the price and as in the absolute quantity, and try to deal with this turnover tax only later in a 1 year or 2 year period of time, moving farther in the direction of the tax reform. Introduction of the valuated tax. Of course, we very well understood that the dangers connected with the combination of the drastic institutional reform, like a price liberalization, and the drastic tax reform, introduction of another tax mechanism, valuated tax. What we also have seen an experience of our friends in Poland, which had to deal with the very difficult problems of introduction of the valuated tax after the reform process was started. We were quite aware that it will be very difficult and very unpopular to do it later. So we thought that if we will all the same have to answer for all of the unpleasant things we have done, the better is to combine all of it together. So then to accept the responsibility for the unpopular tax reform also. So we introduced from the 2nd of January the rather high valuated tax of 28% of the amount of 28% of the valuated. Well, the combination of these measures created possibility for a very drastic change in the composition of the financial flows. Budget deficit, especially the part of the budget deficit that is connected with the money creation, we are excluding the import part of it because it's a difficult and a long discussion. The internal budget deficit was cut rather drastically from 20% of GDP to something very close to zero during the first few months of the year 92. We also, at the period, were able to change rather considerably the position and the policy of the central bank. Central Bank of Russia was created in the period of the fight between the Russian and the Union government. It was created, first of all, for the political purposes to enforce the position of the Russian government And in the time when Union Central Bank was busily engaged into the credits to the Union government in the year 91, Russian Central Bank was busy with providing very cheap and enormous credits to the Russian industries. So the entire ideology of this bank was pro-inflationary ideology. Ideology of the cheap credits, of the popular credits, of the good relationship with the industry, etc. Well, we were happy then to pursue the leadership of the central bank. The situation changed drastically, that they have to be responsibility for the financial stability in Russia now. And we were in a position to change rather drastically their attitude toward the reserve requirement, interest rate, and the amount of credits provided to the economy. The reserve requirements were increased from 5 to 20%. The interest rate was increased, the basic credits was step by step increased from 8 to 80% per year. And the central bank generally kept the money increase during the first half and year of the year 92 in the limits of approximately 9 to 14%. Well, as a result of the combination of the price liberalization and these rather restrictive financial measures, we, during the first half of the year 92, we were in a position to see how step by step the behavior of the economic agents drastically changes. The first expression of this change was, I remember, somewhere around 6th of January, when the angry producers of the cream were storming the White House, asking where they have to sell their cream. Nobody was accepting the cream to sell them, resell them in Moscow, because there were first problems with the lack of demand for these products. Then, step by step, first of all, of course, the problems of the demand were felt on the consumer good markets. First of all, on the market of the consumer goods that could not be kept for a long period of time. Then on the goods produced for the investment purposes, on the military goods, etc. But step by step, problems with the demand for the products, problems not of how to get the resources in the short supply, but the problems of how to sell the products and get the money for them, were more and more predominant problems of the Russian managers. It was very evident, for instance, with the change of the position of the directors of the Russian building enterprises. Usually, the director of the Russian building enterprise in a Russian city was an enormous boss. It just to sign the paper in which it would be told that he may possibly consider the beginning of analyzing the project connected with the building of any object, the enterprise manager would have to knell approximately at least for a quarter of a mile to get this approval. Usually we were trying to construct at least 10 times more than it is sensible to try to construct. So that's why there is a lot of projects we are working 20 years or 30 years or 40 years, etc. Well, in January and February, in the Russian cities, we could see a very strange picture of the building enterprise director running in circles, trying to find who will order him new projects, who will pay the money for his work, to keep, who will provide the necessary financial resources to keep his structures alive. Of course, there was enormous amount of cost push inflation in the first period of a few months. First reaction of the enterprise director on the price liberalization was the drastic increase of the prices, absolutely regardless of the demand possibility, of the obstacles connected with the aggregate demand. The ordinary Russian enterprise director would think, well, you wanted price liberalization. I will show you the price liberalization. Just then, later, he was confronted with the fact that not only he is liberalizing the prices, but his supplier also trying to show him what is the price liberalization. So just in a few months, he would see the real consequences and the real limitations. Of course, the combination of rather restrictive monetary policy and the strong cost push inflation was an enormous arrear crisis, the crisis of the enterprise arrears, which was practically the amortizer, the mean to manage this contradiction between the price aspirations of the enterprises and the real money supply provided by the government and by the central bank. It is a situation that is very well known to all of the economies, to all of the post-communist economies. Even the dimensions of this crisis, of these problems, were not unusual. At the top of the crisis in July of the year 92, the amount of the arrears were approximately equivalent to the two-month GDP. What made this process especially dangerous in Russia was the combination of the macroeconomic phenomena connected with its appearance with the crisis of the payment mechanism connected with the division of the single union ruble zone to the republican ruble zones. Well, as I have mentioned, in December, it was absolutely possible, for instance, in Ukraine, to issue any amount of money and then to transfer it onto the Russian territory. Only from January, we were starting to introduce the mechanism that would at least provide us some information about the monetary emission from another republics to Russia. But we were getting this information approximately 4 weeks later. So we were trying to promote very, very restrictive financial policy. We were cutting down drastically all of the financial expenditure of the state. We were cutting drastically the financial expenditure on the health care, on the education, on the culture. Our salaries in the budgetary field were terribly low from the point of view of the interest of the compassion of the business sector. And then at the same situation, for instance, the republics had an ample possibility of issuing new credits onto the Russian territory. Of course, we understood this problem, and we tried as rapidly as we can to prevent this possibility. But during this first half of the year, we only had the unpleasant consequences of this attempt. And the most unpleasant was the change in the payment mechanism that increased the time necessary for the payments between the Russian enterprises. Combination of this increase of the time of payments and the macroeconomic phenomena connected with the radical decrease of the amount of the percentage of money in the GDP resulted in a very high speed of the creation of this phenomena of the inter-enterprise arrears. At July, it seemed that we generally succeed in resolving our most serious task we were trying to resolve at the beginning of the reforms. We had the minimal and the maximal programs when we started the reforms. The minimal was to convert the repressed inflation to the open inflation, to create the possibility for the creation of the market mechanisms, to preserve the social stability, and to create the legal basis for the start of the privatization process. The maximal program was the minimal program plus prevent of a runaway inflation and prevent of the reappearance of the strong inflationary phenomenon in our economy and the unpleasant consequences connected with the high level of the indexation. At May or June, it looked like as we are generally successful even in the resolution of the maximum program. The rates of inflation were going down from month to month. In July and August, the rates of inflation were on the monthly basis were under the 10%. The economy was more or less liberalized. Behavior of the enterprises changed drastically. The shortages in the shops were practically eliminated. The economy was transferred from the supply constraint to the demand constraint. The most serious worries of the enterprises were connected with the financial possibilities of their customers. So the budget was more or less in a balance. It looked like if we need a little more for the success in the financial stabilization and for the creation of the necessary precondition for the structural reformation of our economy. But, of course, it was only very superficial a picture of what happens and what really happens in our economy. During May and June, it was clear, more and more clear, that it is impossible to keep this economic policy in a long-term perspective. First of all, not because of the economic problem reasons, but because of the poorly political phenomena. Well, during this first month of the year 92, first month of the implementations of the reform program, we created problems for the government, for ourselves, with the military-industrial complex, because of the radical cuts in the amount of the military equipment financing. With the agricultural lobby, because of the cuts in the subsidies. With the general industry, because of the increase of the level of taxation and the general restrictive monetary policy. With the investment sector, because of the drastic cuts in the amount of the demand for the investments. With the budgetary field, because of the delays in the payments in the budget from the budget. And because the salaries of the budgetary enterprises were much lower than in the rest of the economy. So practically, we were in a position when we undermined all of our political basis that could support the policy we were trying to promote. Usually, in every situation, there is, for instance, the sectors and the branches of the economy that could not survive are interested in the continuation of the high inflation because they just would not survive the cuts in the subsidies and the financial stabilization. But there is also the healthy sectors of the economy that are generally interested in the financial stability. In the spring of the year 92, it was evident that the amount of financial distortions is so high that it is it created the alliance, including all of the enterprises against the continuation of the restrictive monetary and the budgetary policy. At the May, when we were probably closer than ever to the success in the financial stabilization, the level of the political support to the continuation of the reform process, if you will see the poll, was lowest ever in the operation of our government. It was quite clear from the point of view of the mass media, public perceptions, that all of the problems in our economy are connected with the fact that it is too small amount of money in the economy. Only thing that is needed is more money. Everything does not work. There's a lot of problems in the industries and the enterprises just because of one fact, too inefficient amount of money. It is clear that only these monetarists from the government, which would not understand the reality, under the influence of the International Monetary Fund, would not understand that there is a simple solution to all of the problems of the Russian economy. Just print more money. In which, with all of our protests, are included additional expenditure in the amount of approximately 8% of GDP. We are losing the contacts with all of the industrial structures. We even cannot anymore count on the unlimited support from the president, because the president is also under the severe pressure to correct this silly policy of financial stabilization. So it's evident that we have two possibilities. So it is evident that this policy will be changed. So we have two possibilities. Either to accept this change and to try to prepare the basis for the maneuver and for the new attempt of economic reform, or to accept this change of economic policy and immediately resign. That was the real and practical alternative approximately in June-July of the year 92. We discussed this situation in the great details and decided that we have to continue our efforts even in this very much changed and unpleasant political situation because of the one very important factor. That is that just in the summer of the year 92, we were in a position to start probably the biggest in the world history program of the privatization of the Russian economy. It was just in a crucial state. We only prepared the organizational structures, we prepared the necessary legislation, necessary decrees of the president, the program of privatization was passed by the parliament, and it was terribly risky that radical change in the direction of the reform will also undermine the chances for the success of this program of the privatization, which can create the basis for the sensible economic policy. Generally, I think that looking from the position in which we are now, that it was a correct decision. But why it was a correct decision, if you would not mind, I would try to explain tomorrow. Thank you.